sahanavavatu sahanau bhunaktu sahaviryam karvavahai tejasvinavaditamastu ma vibhishavahai. Om shantihi shantihi shantihi. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamivavashishyate. Om Shantihi Shantihi Shantihi. Om Asato ma satgamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrityormamritam gamaya. Om shantihi shantihi shantihi. Om tat savitur varam rupam jyoti parasya dhimahi yanna satyena dipaye. Good evening. So we continue tonight with Chapter 8, Memory, Self-Consciousness, and the Ignorance, where memory is a faculty of the mind's self-consciousness. It is not equatable either with the mind or with the field of consciousness available to us, but it is characteristic of that field of the restricted consciousness that we call the ignorance. Sri Aurobindo has been assessing this both from the roots of our individuality and from the roots of the cosmos, all of it summoned forth through the will of the divine conscious being and expressed deliberately, even deliberately in the terms of the ignorance, so that a play of delight could be manifested in a universe which builds to a grand crescendo. In this way, memory is contextualized within the mind, which operates within the manifestation. Memory, as is the mind, is an imperfect agent, incomplete, and we can never take it to be our complete and real self. I think we can take up where we left off last time with this paragraph. For it would be irrational to suppose that the superconscient knowledge is so aloof and separate as to be incapable of knowing time and space and causality and their works. For then it would be only another kind of ignorance, the blindness of the absolute being answering to the blindness of the temporal being as positive pole and negative pole of a conscious existence which is incapable of knowing all itself, but either knows only itself and does not know its works, or knows only its works and does not know itself. An absurdly symmetrical equipollence in mutual rejection, Equipollence, a word which means equal in power. So again, this superconscient knowledge to which he refers is itself an expression of chit. Its mate power is an expression of tapas. Chit tapas is the conscious force of the supreme existence. This consciousness force, native as it looks to itself, and all that it manifests makes clear within its being, must be seizable to its consciousness. It all falls within its ken. So it can't be separated from time, space, causality, or the works that occur within them. It must contain them completely. So you'll wind up with this antinomy. It is either this or that, according to the doings of logic, but not satisfying the deeds of the Supreme within its own being. The being of the Supreme, Sat, as consciousness force expressed through knowledge, even in the restricted field of ignorance, is not incapable, is not blinded, but is fully conscious even behind the veil of all that occurs within it. From the larger point of view, he continues, the ancient Vedantic, we must conceive of ourselves not as a dual being, but as one conscious existence with a double phase of consciousness. One of them is conscient or partly conscient in our mind, the other superconscient to mind. One, a knowledge situated in time, works under its conditions and for that purpose puts itself knowledge behind it. The other, timeless, works out with mastery and knowledge its own self-determined conditions of time. One knows itself only by its growth in time experience. The other knows its timeless self and consciously manifests itself in time experience. So this is a thoroughgoing non-dualism, which we can trace back to the verses of the Isha Upanishad, which will almost immediately make an appearance here. The Isha refuses to divide between vidya and avidya, insists that ignorance be seen as part of the whole of the divine being and manifestation. It must be brought along to have the fullest knowledge. To exclude it is to fall into a blind darkness. Well, let's see what he has to say about that. We realize now what the Upanishad meant when it spoke of Brahman as being both the knowledge and the ignorance, and of the simultaneous knowledge of Brahman in both as the way to immortality. This is Isha Upanishad, verse 11. Knowledge is the inherent power of consciousness of the timeless, spaceless, unconditioned self, which shows itself in its essence as a unity of being. It is this consciousness that alone is real and complete knowledge, because it is an eternal transcendence, which is not only self-aware, but holds in itself, manifests, originates, determines, knows the temporally eternal successions of the universe. So here he's defining the nature of knowledge, and he'll in a moment define the nature of the ignorance. He speaks of the unity of being. It's worth noting that there's a difference between unity and union. He chooses his words very carefully. Unity, from the Latin unus, one, refers to oneness. A single, whole being. No division. Union, which builds from that Latin term, unus, through the French, comes into English, means that which unites, brings into concordance elements or entities into a combined whole. So they have that sense of separability. Unity refers to oneness. Union refers to making a group come together. To continue with his argument here, he's described knowledge as an inherent unity. Ignorance is the consciousness of being in the successions of time, divided in its knowledge by dwelling in the moment, divided in its conception of self-being by dwelling in the divisions of space and the relations of circumstance, self-prisoned in the multiple working of the unity. It is called the ignorance because it has put behind it the knowledge of unity, and by that very fact is unable to know truly or completely either itself or the world, either the transcendent or the universal reality. So if knowledge is inherent unity, ignorance is by its very description and definition division. Division in time, succession, in state of being, this, that, the other. All really one, but unknown to its view, because it has abandoned or left the unity which is characteristic of its essential self. Living within the ignorance, from moment to moment, from field to field, from relation to relation, the conscious soul stumbles on in the error of a fragmentary knowledge. Avidyayam antare vartamanaha, etc. Living and moving within the ignorance, they go round and round, stumbling and battered, men deluded, like the blind led by one who is blind. Mundaka Upanishad 1:2-8. So he's finding in what he calls the ancient Vedanta, the original Vedanta, the Upanishads are what are at the end of the Vedas and thus the Vedanta, affirmations which ring out about the nature of a supreme reality that includes within it even the apparent darkness of ignorance, does not deny its existence. The original Vedanta incorporated, included that, but noted the distinction. It is not a nescience, he writes, but a view and experience of the reality, which is partly true and partly false, as all knowledge must be, which ignores the essence and sees only fugitive parts of the phenomenon. On the other hand, to be shut up in a featureless consciousness of unity, ignorant of the manifest Brahman, is described as itself also a blind darkness. This is Isha Upanishad, verse 9. In truth, neither is precisely darkness, but one is the dazzling by a concentrated light, the other the elusive proportions of things seen in a dispersed, hazy, and broken light, half mist, half seeing. The divine consciousness is not shut up in either, but holds the immutable one and the mutable many in one eternal, all-relating, all-uniting self-knowledge. So it is both the immutable one and the mutable many, the one who never budges, and the many who are always restless and active. One the field of eternity, the other, the field of eternity unrolling itself in the experience of time. Memory in the dividing consciousness is a crutch upon which mind supports itself as it stumbles on, driven helplessly, without possibility of stay or pause, in the rushing speed of time. Memory is a poverty-stricken substitute for an integral, direct, abiding consciousness of self, and a direct, integral, or global perception of things. Mind can only have the direct consciousness of self in the moment of its present being. It can only have some half-direct perception of things as they are offered to it in the present moment of time and the immediate field of space and seized by the senses. It makes up for its deficiency by memory, imagination, thought, idea symbols of various kinds. So memory is a utility of the mind, which is poised in the present, using memory, imagination, etc., as devices by which it extends its reach out, trying to throw off its ignorance and regain knowledge. Its senses are devices by which it lays hold on the appearances of things in the present moment and in the immediate space. Memory, imagination, thought are devices by which it represents to itself, still less directly, the appearances of things beyond the present moment and the immediate space. So this allies well with the thinking of early modern European philosophy that in the present what we get is the gathering of information through our senses. What we look back upon in the past are captured sensations and memories which tell us what we were. The one thing, he writes, which is not a device is its direct self-consciousness in the present moment. Here again, he's speaking of mental awareness. The one thing which is not a device is its direct self-consciousness in the present moment. So again, a reliance on personal experience to be veridical, to be truth-telling. Therefore, through that, it can most easily lay hold on the fact of eternal being, on the reality. So through your own experience, you can most easily gain access to what is beyond time and the reality behind the appearances of things without having to rely on the gathering of senses or the mentation that is instructive in memory or in the power of reason. All the rest, it is tempted, he writes, when it considers things narrowly, to look on not merely as phenomenon, but as possibly error, ignorance, illusion, because they no longer appear to it directly real. We're out of the moment of the immediate experience, and therefore they don't carry that badge of authenticity to us. Of course, this has powerful associations with phenomenology and Merleau-Ponty, etc., in the middle of the 20th century. I promise we won't go there right now. So the illusionist considers them. The only thing he holds to be truly real is that eternal self which lies behind the mind's direct present self-consciousness. So the illusionist, of course, is the Mayavadin. This we're talking about here in reference to Advaita Vedanta, which of course reaches its culmination in the philosophy of Shankara. He continues, or else, like the Buddhist, one comes to regard even that eternal self as an illusion, a representation, a subjective image, a mere imagination or false sensation and false idea of being. Because to the Buddhist, there is no assignable reality behind the ever-shifting image of ourself, which is anatta, no self, because there is nothing there but transience. Grab it. Show me where is that being. You cannot put your hands on it. You can't put your mind on it. It is always elusive because it doesn't exist. Now, Sri Aurobindo, by the way, is taking up both the Mayavada and Buddhism here because it is a standard thing to do, not only in Western philosophy, but in Indian philosophy as well, to address the principal positions of other philosophic schools. So we continue to meet in almost every chapter a rehearsal of what their principal ideas are, because they must be brought into the discussion as they have been relevant to Indian thought for so long and important for the whole of human thought. So let's go forward. Mind becomes to its own view a fantastic magician, its works and itself at once strangely existent and non-existent, a persistent reality and yet a fleeting error, which it accounts for or does not account for, but in any case is determined to slay and get done with both itself and its works, so that it may rest, may cease in the timeless repose of the eternal from the vain representation of appearances. Still here speaking about Buddhism. And you can see between the lines that this could be a direct reference to the greatest of the Buddhist philosophers, Nagarjuna, somewhere between 100, 200 CE, who had an unyielding non-dualism with which he argued in the foundation of his own school of philosophy, the Shunyavada, the teaching of the void. He taught the eight negations and the 14 antinomies, but you can boil them down to a few things. Nothing can be produced, because whatever would be produced already exists in that which contained it ahead of time. So you cannot trace any process. Therefore, causation is an impossibility. And if causation isn't possible, then change also is impossible. If change is not possible, then the material field which we see is not real. Neither is the universe real. Neither is our reference to nirvana accurate, because it must also be illusory, because you can't say anything about it either for or against without referring to these primary experiences and categories just referred to. So there can be no coming, there can be no going. Ultimately, you're driven to recognize that there is a reality beyond mind, a non-dual absolute. There is a kind of an empirical knowledge, and there is an absolute knowledge. You get through the world as best you can by using the empirical knowledge, taking the avenues that open to you to gain access to the absolute, whereby you burn up the illusions and the karma and all that constrains you so that you can live in that. So you can see how much Nagarjuna's arguments likely influenced Shankara and found their way into the argumentation so dominant in the philosophy of India over the last 1,000 years. But let's go forward with Sri Aurobindo. But in truth, our sharp distinctions made between the without and the within, the present and the past self-consciousness, are tricks of the limited, unstable action of mind. Behind the mind, and using it as its own surface activity, there is a stable consciousness in which there is no binding conceptual division between itself in the present and itself in the past and future. And yet, it knows itself in time, in the present, past, and future, but at once, with an undivided view which embraces all the mobile experiences of the time self and holds them on the foundation of the immobile timeless self. So that regnant being who sits in the timeless invests itself also in time, and yet does not lose any of the vision of what we would call past, present, and future. This is the Trikala Drishti, the vision of the three times, which is present in that subconscient knowledge. This consciousness, he says, we can become aware of when we draw back from the mind and its activities, or when these fall silent. So he's describing here a cosmic process and an individual process founded on this Atman, this fundamental reality of conscious being. And he says there are two. When we draw back from the mind, we can enter into that. Or when those activities fall silent, suggesting that there are two yogic processes distinguishable here. But we see first its immobile status. And if we regard only the immobility of the self, we may say of it that it is not only timeless, but actionless, without movement of idea, thought, imagination, memory, will, self-sufficient, self-absorbed, and therefore void of all action of the universe. That then becomes alone real to us, and the rest a vain symbolizing in non-existent forms, or forms corresponding to nothing truly existent, and therefore a dream. But this self-absorption is only an act and resultant state of our consciousness, just as much as was the self-dispersion in thought and memory and will. The real self is the eternal, who is obviously capable of both the mobility in time and the immobility basing time simultaneously. Otherwise, they could not both exist. Nor even could one exist and the other create seemings. This is the Supreme Soul, self and being of the Gita, who upholds both the immobile and the mobile being as the self and lord of all existence. Parapurusha, Bhagavad Gita, chapter 8, verse 22. Paramatman, chapter 15, verses 16 through 19. Parabrahman, chapter 10, verse 15. By the way, a good friend and I, the other day, were doing an audio check. And I thought that I would pick up the synthesis of yoga and read from that, since we read the Life Divine continually on Sunday evening. And I opened to a passage, which I'd like to read to you here. I think you'll see its relevance. But in arriving to these planes, or deriving from them, the limitations of our mentality pursue us. In the first place, the mind is an inveterate divider of the indivisible, and its whole nature is to dwell on one thing at a time to the exclusion of others, or to stress it to the subordination of others. Thus, in approaching Satchit Ananda, it will dwell on its aspect of the pure existence, Sat, and consciousness and bliss are compelled then to lose themselves or remain quiescent in the experience of pure infinite being, which leads to the realization of the quietistic monist. Or it will dwell on the aspect of consciousness, chit, and existence and bliss become then dependent on the experience of an infinite transcendent power and conscious force, which leads to the realization of the tantric worshipper of energy. Or it will dwell on the aspect of delight, ananda, and existence and consciousness then seem to disappear into a bliss without basis of self-possessing awareness or constituent being, which leads to the realization of the Buddhistic seeker of nirvana. Or it will dwell on some aspect of Satchitananda, which comes to the mind from the supramental knowledge, will, or love, and then the infinite impersonal aspect of Satchitananda is almost or quite lost in the experience of the deity, which leads to the realizations of the various religions and to the possession of some supernal world or divine status of the human soul in relation to God. And for those whose object is to depart anywhither from cosmic existence, this is enough, since they are able by the mind's emergence into or seizure upon any one of these principles or aspects to affect through status in the divine planes of their mentality or the possession by them of their waking state this desired transit. Apropos of what we've been reading, absolutely. This is a passage which is in the Synthesis of Yoga, the Yoga of the Integral Knowledge. The chapter is called The Difficulties of the Mental Being. I told you before that the chapter that we're reading right now in The Life Divine appeared in the Arya in December 1916. It was published on 15 December 1916. If you turn the page from The Life Divine, in that, you'll find this very chapter, The Difficulties of the Mental Being. So I think it has been arranged for us to share this with you tonight. Divine synchronicity, if you will. Back to The Life Divine. In this chapter, of course, Sri Aurobindo did revise slightly. This chapter in the Synthesis of Yoga, he left untouched. So far, we arrive by considering mind and memory mainly in regard to the primary phenomenon of mental self-consciousness in time. But if we consider them with regard to self-experience, as well as self-consciousness and other experience, as well as self-experience, we shall find that we arrive at the same result with richer contents and a still clearer light on the nature of the ignorance. At present, let us thus express what we have seen. An eternal conscious being who supports the mobile action of mind on a stable, immobile self-consciousness, free from the action of time, and who, while with a knowledge superior to mind, he embraces all the movement of time, dwells by the action of mind in that movement. As the surface mental entity, moving from moment to moment, not observing his essential self, but only his relation to his experiences of the time movement, in that movement, keeping the future from himself in what appears to be a blank of ignorance and non-existence, but is an unrealized fullness, grasping knowledge and experience of being in the present, putting it away in the past which again appears to be a blank of ignorance and non-existence, partly lighted, partly saved and stored up by memory, he puts on the aspect of a thing fleeting and uncertain, seizing without stability upon things fleeting and uncertain. But in reality, we shall find he is always the same eternal, who is forever stable and self-possessed in his supramental knowledge, and what he seizes on is also forever stable and eternal. For it is himself that he is mentally experiencing in the succession of time. Time is the great bank of conscious existence, turned into values of experience and action. The surface mental being draws upon the past and the future also, and coins it continually into the present. He accounts for and stores up the gains he has gathered in what we call the past, not knowing how ever-present is the past in us. He uses as much of it as he needs as coin of knowledge and realized being, and pays it out as coin of mental, vital, and physical action in the commerce of the present, which creates to his view the new wealth of the future. A great deal of monetary and banking terminology here. That last phrase, which creates to his view the new wealth of the future, he added when he affixed the revisions. Ignorance, he says, is a utilization of the being's self-knowledge in such a way as to make it valuable for time experience and valid for time activity. What we do not know is what we have not yet taken up, coined, and used in our mental experience, or have ceased to coin or use. So this is a rather willful type of oblivion. The eternal has imposed it on itself for the play of the game. Now, behind, all is known and all is ready for use according to the will of the self in its dealings with time and space and causality. In the rest of the chapter, he added when he undertook the revision, and it's brilliant. One might almost say that our surface being is only the deeper eternal self in us, throwing itself out as the adventurer in time, a gambler and speculator in infinite possibilities, limiting itself to the succession of moments, so that it may have all the surprise and delight of the adventure, keeping back its self-knowledge and complete self-being, so that it may win again what it seems to have lost, reconquering all itself through the checkered joy and pain of an aeonic passion and seeking and endeavor. So, that closes our chapter. I think it might be useful when you have the time and the memory to have a look into the synthesis of yoga and find pertinent passages which match up thematically with what we're reading in the Life Divine. You'll find that they are cognate, that the philosophy flows from his experience, and his experience is grounded in the reality of yogic union. Having become one with that, having recovered that great self, having become one with Paramatman, he writes these sentences. So next week we continue in part with the subject of memory, but tonight we conclude with a section from Sri Aurobindo's great epic poem, Savitri. We're going to read the opening section of Book One, the Book of Beginnings, Canto Three, the Yoga of the King, the Yoga of the Soul's Release. A world's desire compelled her mortal birth. One in the front of the immemorial quest, protagonist of the mysterious play, in which the unknown pursues himself through forms and limits his eternity by the hours, and the blind void struggles to live and see, a thinker and toiler in the ideal's air, brought down to earth's dumb need her radiant power. His was a spirit that stooped from larger spheres into our province of ephemeral sight, a colonist from immortality. A pointing beam on earth's uncertain roads, his birth held up a symbol and a sign. His human self, like a translucent cloak, covered the all-wise who leads the unseeing world. Affiliated to cosmic space and time, and paying here God's debt to earth and man, a greater sonship was his native right. Although consenting to mortal ignorance, his knowledge shared the light ineffable. A strength of the original permanence, entangled in the moment at its flow, he kept the vision of the vasts behind. A power was in him from the unknowable, an archivist of the symbols of the beyond, a treasurer of superhuman dreams. He bore the stamp of mighty memories and shed their grandiose ray on human life. His days were a long growth to the supreme. A skyward being, nourishing its roots on sustenance from occult spiritual founts, climbed through white rays to meet an unseen sun. His soul lived as eternity's delegate. His mind was like a fire assailing heaven. His will, a hunter in the trails of light. An ocean impulse lifted every breath. Each action left the footprints of a god. Each moment was a beat of puissant wings. The little plot of our mortality, touched by this tenant from the heights, became a playground of the living infinite. This bodily appearance is not all. The form deceives. The person is a mask. Hid deep in man, celestial powers can dwell. His fragile ship conveys through the sea of years an incognito of the imperishable. A spirit that is a flame of God abides, a fiery portion of the wonderful, artist of his own beauty and delight, immortal in our mortal poverty. This sculptor of the forms of the infinite, this screened, unrecognized inhabitant, initiate of his own veiled mysteries, hides in a small dumb seed his cosmic thought. In the mute strength of the occult idea, determining predestined shape and act, passenger from life to life, from scale to scale, changing his image self from form to form, he regards the icon growing by his gaze, and in the worm foresees the coming God. At last, the traveler in the paths of time arrives on the frontiers of eternity. In the transient symbol of humanity draped, he feels his substance of undying self and loses his kinship to mortality. A beam of the eternal smites his heart. His thought stretches into infinitude. All in him turns to spirit vastnesses. His soul breaks out to join the oversoul. His life is oceaned by that super life. He has drunk from the breasts of the mother of the worlds. A topless supernature fills his frame. She adopts his spirit's everlasting ground as the security of her changing world and shapes the figure of her unborn mites. Namaste. Jai Ma. To all our friends on Zoom, good night then. Good morning to some. So, you come, see. You can all come and see if you want. Just a moment. A few people want to wave at you.
Hi, Vasanti. Morning.
Wonderful. All right. So, namaste. Next week, then. Much love to you all. Good night.